Tonight, Exodus chapter 3, beginning with verse 1, and hopefully we'll get through chapter 4, verse 17. We've taken the first two chapters of Exodus. The book of Exodus describes for us how the Lord led his people out of, that's what Exodus means, God's people out of Egypt. Egypt being a type of the world in the scriptures, and it is a presentation to us of the redemption and salvation that God provides for his people. But the first two chapters we've been dealing with both the children of Israel who are in bondage in Egypt, who are in slavery, who are experiencing hardship under Pharaoh, and at the same time, a man by the name of Moses is being raised by God to lead his people out. And I think it's very significant to follow the life of Moses and how God deals with Moses to get to know the mind of the Lord. Moses spent 40 years as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. She was grooming him to be the Pharaoh, though he was a Hebrew. And when it came time for him to take the throne, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter in order to identify with and suffer with the afflictions of God's people. Well, at that time, we're at the in chapter 2, beginning at verse 11, and we're going to focus on verse 14. Remember, Moses, at the age of 40 years old, decides he's going to go visit his people, the Jews. And when he saw an Egyptian fighting with a Jew, he struck the Egyptian and killed him, buried him in the sand. The next day he saw two of his own people, two Hebrews or two Jews, contending with each other. And the one said, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" So Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." And when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. He would eventually be taken into the house of Reuel, also known as Jethro, in Midian. He was the priest of Midian. And he would marry one of Jethro's daughters. And he would spend 40 more years in the wilderness. God preparing Moses. You would think this man who was, as we saw last week from Acts chapter 7, was raised in all the wisdom and knowledge and languages of the Egyptian culture in order to be a world leader, that he was now prepared by to lead God's people. At least he thought so. He reached out and killed the Egyptian, and he was God's ruler. Going to free God's people with his own strength and might. He was the mighty man of God. But God sent him out into the desert for 40 more years. And we see why. Because God is going to deliver his people out of Egypt and through the wilderness. So Moses had to know how to live and fellowship with the Lord and how to live and make it in the wilderness. Because that's where he's going to take God's people. So God spent 80 years preparing Moses. 80 years to prepare him for this journey through the wilderness. The Lord is not in a hurry. And he uses prepared people. And out of the books of true confession, I think every person in the ministry or everyone who has felt led to share or have participated in God's work in some way, shape, or form can identify a lot with Moses. You feel called of God and you reach out with all in the name of the Lord with all your physical strength and might and authority in the Lord, and you find out that you kill everybody. And it wasn't God's timing. He gives us a call and then he prepares us for it. So he spent 40 years there. Verse 23 of chapter 2, "Now it came to pass in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage. And they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob." I think that's very significant for us today. God remembers His covenant through His Son, Jesus Christ, not only to the world, but to us as His people. It is not based on our goodness or any good works that we can present to the Lord to say, Lord, I deserve Your mercy and I deserve Your grace and I deserve Your help and ministry, but it's based on His promise through His Son, Jesus Christ, based on the finished work of Christ. But God remembered His covenant with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and God looked upon the children of Israel and God acknowledged them. He took notice of them. He knew it all along, but they were coming to a point. We'll see this as we're developing two thoughts here. Moses and his relationship with the Lord and the children of Israel. Why does God take so long? He's preparing both people. They're groaning because of the hardships, but they're not ready yet. Just because somebody cries out in the hardships of life doesn't mean they're ready to receive the Lord's help or to even turn their life over to Christ. I mean, I, for the longest time, would begin reading the book of Exodus over and over again and read how the children of Israel cried out and groaned because of the bondage and the hardships they were in. And I'm sitting there looking at how God's handling this and I'm thinking, gee, how many years? I mean, we're looking at 40 more years here by the time Moses is prepared and ready to get back. I mean, is it Moses' fault? Are the people saying, come on, Moses, get prepared, will you? How long does it take you to get through seminary anyway? 40 years? It's only a 3-year institution. Get back here and deliver us. Be the leader that God wants you to be. 40 more years. 40 more years. 80 years in all. But God's in control. God's not in a hurry.
He knows he hasn't seen anything yet. The last 40 years weren't easy.
That's true. That's true. Chapter 3, verse 1. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now Horeb is the name of the mountain chain. One of the peaks of this mountain chain is Mount Sinai. So Moses is actually at the place at the back of the desert where God is going to lead his people. And he is now a shepherd. He's taking the flock. He used to be a man educated in the things of the Egyptians. And you remember the Egyptians thought the shepherds who kept the flock were an abomination to them. And all of a sudden, Moses is chased out of Egypt and now he's in Midian. And what is he? He's a shepherd, keeping the flock of his father-in-law. So now God's teaching him how to be a shepherd and how to live in the wilderness. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. And by the way, the word bush in Hebrew is a thorn bush. This is not just some ordinary bush sitting there. This is a thorn bush. And many teachers take the very symbolic meanings here to talk about the thorns upon which Christ died and the Lord revealing himself through the anguish of the bush would probably symbolize that, but more so the anguish that through the thorns of the sufferings of God's people, the Jews, in this particular situation, God appears. So he appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of the bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look. Now the word Lord, I read it Lord, but in Hebrew it's the word Yahweh. Okay? Notice in verse 2, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him. Then when Moses turned aside, then Yahweh saw that he turned aside to look, and Elohim, that is God, called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses, and he said, here am I. So the angel of the Lord, if you put all of this together, the angel of the Lord and Yahweh and Elohim are all the same. And this is where some of the cults get this idea, because this is a Christophany. or a theophany, depending on how you want to look at it. An appearance of God, an appearance of Christ to Moses as Christ appeared to him in the burning bush.
Isn't the angel of the Lord always the Lord Jesus Christ?
Yeah, the Lord Jesus Christ. But what I'm saying is the cults take that and say, which is what the writer of Hebrews refuted, is that Jesus is an angel. He's a created being, and that he is the head angel of God, and he was sent as a messenger of God. The problem is, in understanding all of this, is both the Hebrew and Greek words for the word angel is the word messenger. It can be applied to pastors of churches. It could be applied to the spiritual beings that we call angels. The word is used both, but one means to announce or a messenger, and the other one means angel. It all depends which being, which created being you're applying the word to. This is what's important about word studies. Is why if you handle the English language, for instance, if you look up a word in the dictionary and say this word means this, well, that's fine, but in context, what is it making reference to? If the basic word means messenger, what is he talking about, a created spiritual being called an angel? Or is he talking about a pastor of a church? Is he talking about an apostle? Is he talking about an evangelist? What's he talking about? And so it has to be in context. The word is so general. And the cults really make a play on this and say, well, see, the angel of the Lord is none other than Jesus Christ himself. So he is an angel. You see, he is not God in the flesh. But all the word angel means is messenger. So it doesn't mean that Jesus took the form of an angel, said, come here, Gabriel, let me use you, and took on the form of an angel and appeared to people. It doesn't mean that at all. He is, in fact, in the Hebrew, it has a definite article with it, he is the messenger of Jehovah. He's none other than Jesus Christ himself. He's not only the messenger, but he is also Yahweh himself and Elohim himself. All the names of God is the same spirit that's speaking through this flame that does not consume the bush. So he says, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals from off of your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Point number one. Remember that. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father. That would be Elohim. The Elohim of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. The term Elohim just is the general term for God in scriptures, and it is a reference to the almightiness of God, the all-encompassing God. Yahweh has to do with the eternally existent one. You remember that, because that will be what he says his name is here pretty soon. By eternally existent one, it means that he has encompassed past, present, and future all at the same time. That's beyond our comprehension. That's what Yahweh means. In fact, one Bible teacher once said, and just stuck in my head, illustrations stick real well with me. But he once said, and whether this applies or not, it helps get the point across, is that God already knew and already knows from the beginning of creation till the end of time when this whole thing is all over, he already knows everything that's going to happen and what every single person is going to do, all the decisions they're going to make, and at the end, every person that's going to be with Christ and every person that's not going to be with Christ. He already knows that even before the foundation of the world. So basically, and what this person said was, basically what God's watching now is a rerun. It has already happened. In his mind, next year is already fact. It's already history. Because he is the eternal one, and he's going to reveal himself as the eternal one. This is fascinating about how God reveals himself by the various names that he uses of himself. When he tells, for instance, Moses, I am the eternally existent one, Moses. I already know what's going to happen. I've already been there. I already encompass all of eternity. Past, present, and future. It's a done deal. I already know what's going to happen. I already got it planned out. So when he presents himself as Yahweh, he is the eternally existent one. He's already been there. Got it all planned. It's already happened. It's fact. But the two things that he told Moses, first of all, take your sandals off. the place, the ground that you stand on is holy. And second of all, Moses fell upon, hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. One of the things I noticed about what God told Moses and Moses' response in his fear and respect for the Lord is what the writer of Proverbs in Proverbs chapter 1 said. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. How often we parade ourselves with our rebellion and our arrogance, even in the house of the Lord. I mean, I've seen both myself and I've seen other people. And we'll get to it in a moment. Actually have the attitude of, well, who does he think he is? Or who do these people think they are? And somebody gives up and gives a testimony about how they came to know the Lord. Well, who does that person think they are? And we don't realize that we're in the presence of the Lord. Not people. People are not the Lord. But his Spirit is with us when we gather together in his name. And people, we have a disregard and disrespect for his word. We think that we can take it or leave it. It's just there. We believe it as doctrine. It's holy ground. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Verse 7, and Yahweh said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people. Now notice the personal pronouns, I. I'm going to point these out to you as we go through. This is God speaking, the Eternal One. I have surely seen the oppression of my people. I have seen, and they are my people who are in Egypt. And I have heard their cry because of the taskmasters, for I know their grief. This is God speaking. I've seen, I know, I've heard. So I have come down to deliver them. A picture of Christ. What did Jesus do when he took on human flesh? He came down to deliver us. He left glory. He emptied himself. I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians. Notice God says, I'm going to do it, not you, not anybody else. I'm coming down and I'm going to deliver them out of the hands of the Egyptians. And I am going to bring them up from that land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now, therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me. This is God speaking. And I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Now, all this time, God says, I have seen, I have heard, I'm going to deliver. Now, you go. You go to Pharaoh to let my people go. Moses' response. Now, 40 years earlier, he responded in strength and authority. He even killed a man, in the name of Jesus, of course. In the name of the Lord, to free his people, to protect his people, you know, he was God's judge. Remember in Acts chapter 7, verse 25 from last week? It says, Moses, when he killed the Egyptians, and he thought that his people, the Jews, would know that he was the judge. God had sent him to be the ruler and the judge, but they didn't understand. He said, look, folks, I'm the sent one of God. See? So Moses presumed that God's people would understand at that point. Now, 40 years later, God is giving his call to Moses. He says, you're going to be the vessel, but I'm going to do it. And I'm the Eternal One, and I already got the thing planned out. In fact, it's already happened. Even before you get there, it's already happened. So he says, you go. Now notice this, verse 11. Here's our mighty man of God. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? And some people think that's very humble, but it isn't. You don't have to take my word for it. As we pass through these scriptures, you will see. God told Moses who God was. He didn't ask Moses, who are you? God says, it's not who you are, it's who I am. So Moses said, who am I that you should send me? Moses looking at himself, his inadequacies. Look what 40 years has done to him. He swung from far left to far right. From, look who I am, the mighty man of God, the called man of God, come to deliver God's people. Now he's saying, who am I that God should use me? I'm inadequate. Who am I? That's not even the question. The question really is, who is God? So he said, I will certainly be with you. That's the grace of God. He says, look, it's not really who you are. And God didn't really chastise him for it. He says, I'll be with you, Moses. It's not you, it's me. I will be with you. I will deliver. Remember, I just told you what I'm going to do? I will be with you. And this shall be a sign to you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. You would think that God would perform something a little better than that, like right now, Lord. I mean, there's only a burning bush that isn't consumed, and God's only speaking to him. But God's given him a certainty. He says, look, when you deliver them out, you will serve on this mountain. That'll be assigned to you. You mean I have to wait? Wait till I get back here? Then Moses said to God, indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? So first of all, he says, who am I? And second of all, he says, who are you? When I go and they start questioning me and really want to get down to the nitty-gritty and the details, and I say the God, notice what he says, when I say the Elohim of your fathers has sent me, well, isn't that all that's needed? The God of Abraham, the God of Jacob, the God of Isaac, the one who remembered his covenant, wouldn't they know who that is? But he wants something more detailed. Tell me your name. What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. That's Yahweh, Asher Yahweh. The term I am is the eternally existent one. The God who has the characteristics and qualities of eternity, all encompassed within himself. This is why in the Gospel of John, when they came to Jesus, and Jesus said to them, when he was talking about Abraham, Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. He wasn't saying, I am he. Some English texts have italics the word he. Jesus was saying, I am. In the Garden of Gethsemane, when the crowds came out with the sticks and the torches, and they came out to get Jesus, and Jesus said, whom are you seeking? And they said, Jesus the Nazarene. He said, I am. He didn't say, I am he, like I have a name tag, because I don't have a name tag. I'm the one you're looking for. He said, I am, and they all fell over. He's Yahweh.
He fell backwards to it.
Yeah. That's true.
That would have been enough for me.
So God says to Moses, Yahweh is who Yahweh is, okay? The eternally existent one. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Now this is supposed to be from Moses. The eternally existent one, the one who has already been there, already his divine plan, it's already happened, Moses, just go. Moreover, God said to Moses, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, the Lord God, Yahweh Elohim of your fathers, the Elohim of Abraham, the Elohim of Isaac, and the Elohim of Jacob has sent me to you. See? That's how the children of Israel know him. They know him as the Elohim, or God, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's through whom he has his covenant. So he says, you go to the children of Israel and tell him, the Elohim, or God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has sent me to you, and this is my name forever. And this is my memorial to all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, Yahweh Elohim of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me, saying, I have surely visited you and seen what is done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, to a land flowing with milk and honey. Then they will take heed or listen to your voice. And you shall come, you and the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, Yahweh Elohim of the Hebrews has met with us, and let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go. Now this is God speaking. Now I've already told you. Now notice what he says. They will listen to you and they will come. You and the elders. You will go to this Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and you will ask to go 3 days' journey. You may sacrifice and worship. But I am also certain that he will not let you go. So look at what God's saying. He's not going to let you go. And you can just see Abraham, you can just see Moses' response. Then why send me? You know? He will not let you go, no, not even by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand. Now God's saying, this is what I'm going to do. He's not going to let you go. I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in its midst. And after that, he will let you go. Now, he will let you go. A promise. And he's just laid it out for Moses. I wish, you know, I wish he would do that for us. We probably still wouldn't believe it. Each week at your church fellowship for the next year, here's what's going to happen each week. Well, gee, that'd be great. We'd know all the ups and downs and everything that's going to happen, even ahead of time. And then when we get there and it happens, we can say, well, didn't God say he was going to do this? So we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, God just laid it out for him. Everything that's going to happen. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be when you go that you shall not go empty-handed, but every woman shall ask of her neighbor, namely of her who dwells near her house, articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and on your daughters, so you shall plunder the Egyptians. Now basically in the Hebrew, what it's saying is presenting past wages here. God is saying you've been in slavery for all these years, but you're not going to go empty-handed. They're going to give you their jewelry and their gold and all of the things. And so you shall plunder the Egyptians. Now, that's beautiful. There's no problem there. In fact, God didn't even tell Moses what he had to do. God says, here's what I'm going to do, step by step by step. They will let you go. You will leave. And when you do leave, you will do this and this will happen. Chapter 4, verse 1. Then Moses answered and said, praise the Lord, let's get it on. No. But suppose they will not believe me. Suppose they will not believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say, the Lord has not appeared to you. Didn't God just say, they will listen to you, they will go with you, but Pharaoh will not let you go. But therefore, I'm going to have to do this. Then they will let you go. You will leave. But Moses said, now, wait a minute. What happens if I go and they don't believe me? What happens if they don't listen to me? Now, don't think that every person who's ever led a Bible study or been called to some kind of ministry or even a one-on-one thing, when you come home from work and you feel like the Lord's convicting your heart that the Lord wants you to speak to somebody at work because they've been talking to you about the Lord, and you just, okay, Lord, I've really got to be a witness for this person. And you're really praying about God using you as a witness. Don't ever think that it doesn't cross through someone's mind in their insecurities. What happens when I open this book and stand up in front of all those people, the Lord decides to take the night off? And I'm stuck up there. What happens? What happens if God's not with me and he doesn't do anything? What happens if all those people sit there and go, well, we hear a voice and we see a person that we... What happens if God just leaves me and I have to fill in material here? I don't know what to say. You know. What if he just leaves me out in the limb? What if God's not in this thing at all? He promised, right? But... what if he doesn't? What if they say the Lord has not appeared? Now remember 40 years earlier what they said to him. Who made you a ruler and judge over us? That's stuck in his mind. He said, what if I go back? And they say, who do you think you are? I mean, he's already said, who am I? Well, what happens if they say, who are you? Well, you're really in a predicament. So the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a rod. Another term, English word that's used for this Hebrew word is a staff. The shepherd's staff, a rod. Walking stick, as well as a guide for the sheep. So God said, cast it onto the ground. So he cast it onto the ground, and it became a snake. And Moses fled from it. It shows the character of Moses. Just a minute, I'll share with you exactly what's going on here. Then the Lord said to Moses, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. And he reached out his hand and caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. That they may believe that the Lord God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has appeared to you. This is going to be a sign. Okay, Moses, I'm going to help you out. You don't believe my word, so I'm going to provide a miracle for you. In fact, you can do this in front of the people, and they will know that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has appeared to you. How's that? Am I helping you? Am I helping you believe, Moses? Hard man to persuade. The rod, interesting word, and the same Hebrew word is found in Psalm 110, verse 1. You might want to write that down or turn to it if you want to. Psalm 110, verse 2, excuse me. This is in reference to, it's also in Psalm 2, where Jesus Christ shall rule the nations with a rod of iron. But in Psalm 110, beginning with verse 1, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. This will be during the reign of Christ upon the earth. The Lord shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion. Rule in the midst of your enemies. It is the rod, same word that's used here in Exodus chapter 4. Who is the rod who is to appear? Jesus Christ. He is the authority. The rod is a symbol of authority, of leadership. Also for Moses is what he leaned on to walk on. Everything from authority to dependency was typified and exampled in this rod or staff. So he says, throw it onto the ground, symbolizing the fact that if Moses should throw his authority and his trust in the Lord under the ground, what happens? It becomes a snake. What does the snake represent? Satan. He throws the Lord away and his dependency and trust on him. He'll be given in to the snake. And what does he do? He's afraid of the snake. He showed exactly where his heart was. He's afraid of Satan. So God says, take him by the tail. Of course, Satan's head hasn't been crushed yet, not until we got to the cross. But God says, take him by the tail. And that's the authority of Christ, you see. You take Satan by the tail, and what happens is, you get your authority back. Your trust. So not only was he providing a sign for Moses that his authority was in the Lord, with the rod, who is Jesus Christ, but also, if he was to cast this authority away, cast his trust away, then it turns into a snake. But if he takes the snake by the tail under the authority of Christ, that's where his leadership lies. It's also a sign to the Jews. Verse 6, furthermore, there's actually three signs. Furthermore, the Lord said to him, now put your hand in your bosom. And he put his hand in his bosom. And this is, of course, the hand of the... Here's the mighty hand of God going to lead the people. Where's the bosom but the heart? Put your hand in your bosom. And he put his hand in his bosom. And when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. It's not that it became leprous, except for the fact that the symbol is that what he put his hand of leadership over his heart is that it came out leprous. The heart is what corrupts. And God's people had been in bondage, and they've been crying out to him. This would be a symbol both to Moses that his heart needed to be right for his hand of leadership and deliverance, and the children of Israel also, that God was able to deliver them. And he said, put your hand in your bosom again. So he put his hand in his bosom again and drew it out of his bosom, and behold, it was restored like his other flesh. God healed the leprosy. Leprosy in the scriptures, we know from Leviticus chapters 13 and 14, as well as our studies and the teachings in the Gospels, that leprosy is a type and representation of sin. So God says, you take your hand of leadership and put it over your heart of sin, it's going to corrupt. But God is able to heal. He's able to cleanse. And it's only by the cleansing and leadership and authority of Christ over the heart and over the walk that this is possible. Then it will be that if they do not believe you nor heed the message of the first sign, and they may believe the message of the latter sign. And it shall be that if they do not believe even though these two signs, or listen to your voice, that you shall take water from the river, which is literally the Nile, and pour it upon the dry land. And the water which you take from the river will become blood on the dry land. We know from later on that this is one of the judgments of God upon the Egyptians. It's a warning. This third sign is a warning to take heed. If they do not believe the Lord, the outpouring of blood was, of course, a symbol of death. Then Moses said to the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent. Neither before nor since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. So he's saying, you can't use me. Remember he said, who am I? God says, I'm not talking about you. All this time I'm telling you who I am. I'm not talking about who you are. I'm talking about me. And all Moses is saying, but you can't use me because of who I am. Literally in the Hebrew, I got marbles in my mouth every time I talk. I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue. I can't talk. I'm not an eloquent speaker. Now here's a man that's been raised in the culture of the Egyptians and the languages of the world, and he says, I can't speak very well. I remember Paul in speaking to the church at Corinth. He said, I didn't come to you with the words of man's wisdom, but I came into you with the power of God's Spirit. I didn't come to you to try to salesmanship you. I came in the demonstration of God's power, God's Spirit. In fact, he said to them, again in another place, to the Christians in Corinth, he said, though I am unpolished in speech, yet not in knowledge. If Paul were to stand up and give a sermon, or to speak at some seminary someplace, they'd cut him apart. And yet Paul could turn around and say, well, you're right. I'm unpolished in speech. I don't have it together. Can't sit down and prepare a sermon. But I'll tell you something. The substance of what I'm telling you is true. Start listening to the substance instead of the style. So Moses said, I'm not eloquent. Even before you spoke to me. I mean, this is not an excuse, God. Even before you spoke to me, I wasn't able to speak very good. So the Lord said to him. Now, verse 11 is a very important verse. Please note. Anybody wants to take issue with God, everybody in the healing scenes and whatever of today. So the Lord said to him, who has made man's mouth? Who made your mouth, Moses? Or who makes the mute? I want you to notice this. God is saying, who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have not I the Lord? Wow. God says, if a person can see or they're made blind, the only way they're that way is because I've made them that way. If a person is mute and can't speak, or they're eloquent in speech, whatever their situation is, it's because I, the Lord, have done it. There's a lot of people don't like that. What he's saying to Moses is, if that's true, Moses, if it's true that you're not eloquent in speech, I made you that way. And maybe I just want you to be that way. Maybe I want you physically afflicted or defected or however you want to look at it, so that when I speak through you, it'll be the power of God and it will not be the eloquence of man. Get the point, Moses? See? Maybe God will make someone mute or deaf or blind for the glory of God. There's some people that can't accept that, but that's what God's saying right here. It is not dependent upon the superiority of the function of a human being's flesh. It is totally dependent upon the superiority of God and who He is. And in order to bring out that superiority of Christ's Spirit and the power of God's Spirit, He'll do just the opposite, like He did with Paul. He sent a messenger of Satan, was sent to Paul to buffet him, lest he should be exalted above measure, so that he could be usable of the Lord. Because God says, when you're weak, my strength is strong. Now Paul says, oh, I got it. My flesh has to be weak before your spirit is strong. I get it now. He stopped asking for deliverance. Some people just don't like to accept that. They say, no, Paul was wrong. We have better revelation today. If Paul knew what we knew today in personal revelation, he would have been delivered from this messenger of Satan, because God does not will that to happen. God's not hurting anybody. God is saying, I am going to fix your flesh to the point where I can use you. And whatever it takes to humble you, whatever it takes for it to be the glory of God and not the glory of man, God says, I will do it. And people, we as people, we just can't accept it. How many years is it going to take before we finally submit to the work of God, both spiritually and physically? He will humble us. I, the Lord, have done it. Whether a person can speak or they're mute, whether they can see or they're blind, whether they can hear or they're deaf, I have done it, God says. Now therefore, go, and I will be with your mouth, and I will teach you what you will say. Wow. But he said, oh my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send. If you have the word else in your text, notice it's in italics. Literally in the Hebrew, he says, praise the Lord for this mighty work that you're about to do upon whomever you're going to send, as long as it's not me. Whoever this person is that you're talking about, that you're going to do this work through, God bless them. I'm all for it. God's been saying, Moses, no, you don't understand, it's you. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. That's it. All this time you've been talking about your inadequacies, which I already know, which I've created. But all this time I've been telling you about myself, what I'm going to do. Not what you're going to do, but what I'm going to do through you. And you keep making excuses. He's gone from far left to far right. Oh, God can't use me. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And he said, is not Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well. This is a rebuke, by the way. And behold, he is also coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. Now remember, Aaron is still back in Egypt. Moses is in Midian. And while God is speaking to Moses, God was also working on the other end and said, Aaron, go meet Moses. Now how did he know Moses was coming? How did he know that God was going to appear to Moses 40 years later, to the day, the hour, and the second, and say, well, okay, I guess Moses ought to be coming back any time now. It's been 40 years. But God was working through Aaron. Probably shocked Moses. Said, okay, I've been wrestling with you long enough. Aaron, your brother, is already on his way. He's coming out to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. Now you shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you what you shall do. So he shall be your spokesman to the people, and he himself shall be as a mouth for you. This is the grace of God and also the rebuke of God. He says, I'm going to use you anyway. Now if you're not going to speak, I'll have somebody else speak for you. I've let somebody else be your mouth if you're not going to trust me. But you're still going to go through this ordeal anyway. That's right. That's right. It was the grace of God providing the mouthpiece, but the disunity between the two and the problems that would come up later, especially when Moses comes down off the mountain and he finds out that Aaron has made a golden calf with the jewelry from the people, and there's just no unity there. So he shall be the spokesman to the people. He himself shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be to him as God, as the representative of God. Can you imagine the embarrassment, though? I mean, God's grace, but at the same time, the problems that exist. Moses is hearing from God, and he's saying, Aaron, tell Pharaoh. You know, it's like, why don't you tell him yourself? Oh, who am I? Who am I that I should, you know, Aaron, tell him that God said, and he's quite a sight. And you shall be as representative of God, and you shall take this rod in your hand with which you shall do the signs. And we'll pick up next time at verse 18 as we continue to see how this drama is going to unfold and how they're going to come before Pharaoh. There's some other things, but we wanted to reserve this little section of how God dealt with Moses, how we can be so zealous and assertive for the Lord. And if you're in the same situation that I'm in, the same experiences that I've had in your early years with the Lord, you're very assertive and very strong, and thus saith the Lord, and you're just steamrolling people over, and you're rebuking people, and you're doing this and that. And then as God deals with you down through the years, as He humbles you and tries to mellow you out and make you see how it has to be the Lord, and He humbles us in these situations, then you get to a point where God says, okay, let's get back into it again, and you sit there and go, oh no. I remember how I used to be. Oh, I'm so inadequate. I've blown it. God, you don't want to use me. Look at the way I blew it before, and I can't be used anymore. And then you begin to look at your inadequacy. Before, it's you present yourself in attitude of look at God's chosen gift to you, folks. You know, look at the anointed of the Lord. Behold, I am here. You know, but then over a period of years, God shows you the foolishness of it, that it isn't you, it's Him. It's not your timing, it's His timing. So over a period of years, He humbles us to show us how much we need to totally depend upon Him and trust Him. But we see the whole opposite perspective. We say, oh, look how inadequate I am. I see myself now as so in the flesh. And then you begin to notice all the other human weaknesses. Oh, I can't speak well. You know, I don't. Don't have a college education. That's right. No degree, and yes. And who are you to baptize? You're not ordained, right? Or any of these things. You don't have the certificate. Say Midian, University of Midian.
Yeah. Experience, but back then I didn't even have that.
Right, right.
And I can identify with
Sure. I as well. It's just, but see, we can swing both ways.